From North Carolina to Washington, New York to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Trump administration's efforts at cutting federal regulations have saved American businesses billions of dollars. Ken Cuccinelli of FreedomWorks is here to talk about just how much has been saved and how it has helped to revive the nation's economy. Republicans appear poised to gain seats in the U.S. Senate, but likely Democrats will take control of the House. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth is here with a real story. The Supreme Court of the United States will be hearing two pivotal cases relating to constitutional issues involving double jeopardy and excessive fines. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And Sprint and T-Mobile have announced plans to merge their operations. Will this harm competition or improve customer service? Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA offers his take on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The White House Office of Management and Budget has announced the Trump administration's efforts at regulatory relief have resulted in $23 billion in cost savings. Here to talk about the lessening regulatory burden on business is Ken Cuccinelli. Ken is a former Virginia Attorney General who now serves as director of the Regulatory Action Center at the FreedomWorks Foundation. Ken, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ken, we know that the Trump administration has made regulatory relief a top priority. Can you give us an update on the progress that the administration is making in this area?
They just put out a semi-annual report, and a lot of these things have been very boring in the past and, frankly, very burdensome, but they're very proud of their work, and they have every right to be. In the most recent period of time, they've saved annual savings of over $1 billion, with a lifetime savings of $23 billion. And when you compare that to the same period for the Obama administration, during the same period, they imposed $235 billion worth of regulatory costs. And that produces no wealth. It makes no one richer. It makes our economy poorer by that amount of money, because these are just transaction costs that businesses have to bear just to exist. So to reduce them, as the Trump administration has done and has made clear it's going to continue to do, has really helped boost economic growth and opportunity for every American.
When you talk, Ken, about regulatory costs on business, most Americans, of course, don't run a business, although everybody is dependent upon them for income. So tell us a little bit, in a little bit more depth, what you mean by the term a regulatory cost to the business. What burden does this place on businesses, and how does that affect the ordinary worker?
So let's use a simple example. When I left the Attorney General's office of Virginia, I've been doing a number of things since then, but one of them you might not expect. With three other people that I know, we started an oyster business in the Chesapeake Bay. Now, and it's still going 4 years later, it's going well. Tangier Island Oyster Company in the Tangier Islands in the middle of the bay. Well, as you know, seafood has certain safety risks with it. And we have to, when we pull the oysters out of the bay, we have to do it before 10 a.m. during the summer, so there's not much sun and heat. We have to have them on ice and in certain temperature ranges. And there are reasons for that. Those are health and safety regulations. Somebody like me, a very minimalistic person when it comes to government regulation, thinks those make sense. And we had to take classes and learn them and so forth. But if you're a business like a barber, say you wanted to start a haircut, I'll call it a salon, you have to go get a cosmetology license from your state. And typically you have to take hundreds of hours of classes. And this is just to cut hair. Let's set aside using chemicals and coloring hair and things like that, just to cut hair. Well, why on earth should you have to do any of that? And what does it do? What it does is it doesn't allow poor people to just, boom, start up a haircut business. And I'll tell you what, if I go to your haircut business and you don't cut my hair well, guess what? I'm not coming back. The market will take care of it. When there aren't health and safety burdens at issue, government shouldn't be regulating. It shouldn't be regulating. And the federal government regulates building codes and other things that should be left to states and local governments. The closer the government is to us, the more responsive it is to us. And that's a principle the founders talked about. This isn't new. And the Trump administration is peeling away layers of federal regulation that give us more opportunities to start up small businesses. One of the things we saw in the Obama administration is a nosedive in entrepreneurial spirit. That people, America has distinguished itself in our history by our do-it-yourself attitude, up by your bootstraps, willingness to take risks, and part of that is starting businesses. Well, the effort to start new businesses came to not a screeching halt under the Obama administration, but it dropped to record lows. And that has all turned around. A very common response of a business person 5 years ago to the burdens that government was placing on them was, if I had to start my business today, I wouldn't do it, or I couldn't do it. Well, that attitude is changing, and you see it reflected in the optimism of small business owners, and there are organizations that measure that optimism. It's the highest it's been in decades. And a lot of that is not because of just the tax bill, which is what a lot of people focus on, is lower taxes. It's because government is making an effort, an affirmative effort, to get out of the way, to expand freedom and opportunity in the form of getting rid of unnecessary regulations. It has real big effects all across our economy. Even if you don't own that business can now hire one more person. It can invest in R&D. It can buy a new machine or expand to a new plant. It can do all those things because it's not spending that money just to comply with regulatory oversight.
Interesting, those surveys that you just referenced can often show that regulation is a bigger problem, a bigger roadblock for many businesses than even taxes are.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, some of the recent surveys with the economy doing so well showing finding qualified workers has risen to the top of the list as a problem, followed by regulatory relief, and taxes now in third place. So when we look at this regulatory relief that is occurring, and now regulatory relief is not the number one problem because of it, can you Right. drill down a little bit and tell us what specific areas has the Trump administration been successful in terms of cutting regulations, and where might we see them go in the future?
In the last year, you've seen a primary driver is Health and Human Services, and you'll see that over the course of the next year as well, where because of the massive cost of health care, as the federal government has stripped away regulations blocking what businesses can do and creating more options, many of those options cost less money. And so give them, those businesses, the opportunity to get health care at a lower cost and to do those kinds of things. And those have been major, major cost drivers. I'm using very rough numbers here, but HHS has been responsible for about half of the regulatory savings, and most of that is in the healthcare area. And I think you can expect to continue to see that going forward as we see new announcements out of the Trump administration about how they're stripping away requirements off Obamacare to make it easier to comply with, to make it cost less for businesses to comply with, and thereby allow them to extend healthcare opportunities to their workers that don't otherwise exist.
We have been talking with Ken Cuccinelli, who is director of the Regulatory Action Center at the FreedomWorks Foundation. And Ken, tell us just a little bit about FreedomWorks and where can folks go to learn more?
FreedomWorks is on the web at freedomworks.org. FreedomWorks has four organizations. Two of them are political PACs, and then one is a 501c4, which works on legislation to cut taxes, and welfare reform is a top priority for us. And then in the foundation where I work, the 501c3, we fight regulations and we do education of Americans.
We have been again talking with Ken Cuccinelli of FreedomWorks. Ken, thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you again.
Andy Roth is at the offices of the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C., but of course he is keeping a very close eye on a number of very hotly contested U.S. Senate races around the country. Also, party control of Congress is up in the air. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
There appears to be better and better news for Republicans when it comes to retaining control of the U.S. Senate, perhaps even an opportunity for Republicans to expand their majority there. First of all, Andy, are there any of these key races that have been hotly contested that you think now are sort of moving heavily into one camp or the other?
Let me start with the seats that Republicans are defending. They're defending 8 total, and immediately once the cycle started, 6 of those were completely safe and only 2 were in jeopardy. But because of retirements and a few other things, that number has expanded to 4. And so you have Ted Cruz in Texas, Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee, Martha McSally in Arizona, and Dean Heller in Nevada. And at one point in time, all of those looked like they could get lost. I think Ted Cruz is now safely going to get reelected, barring some unforeseen disaster. I think the same thing can be said about Marsha Blackburn. And then in Arizona and in Nevada, I think that the Republican candidates there are slowly pulling away. The Democrat in Arizona, Kyrsten Sinema, had just a disastrous last couple of weeks. She was recorded on tape calling Arizona a meth lab and a few other things. So that is looking better and better for Republicans, and so is Nevada. So if you assume all of those are safe, then that means that Republicans are playing offense going into Election Day. And so the number one pickup, I think, is North Dakota. That one is getting almost to the point of ridiculous of how safe that is for Republicans. And then after that, you've got a couple of races like Missouri, Indiana, and Florida that are very, very close. I would say Missouri is probably the next likely to go for Republicans, and then Indiana and Florida. So right there, that's 4 seats. And then you've got Montana and West Virginia that are tightening that Republicans could pick up as well. So then you've got 6. Now, I think it would be an extreme long shot if Republicans picked up all 6 seats, but if they did, the majority would go from 51 to 57. And boy, that would be a huge, resounding defeat of the Democrats and their agenda. It might incite a lot of introspection on the Democrats' part that they were able to lose all of those seats when Trump became such a polarizing figure, and yet he was still able to help pick up all of those seats. So it will be a remarkable thing to watch on Election Day, but I do think that things are definitely going in the Republicans' favor.
One state we haven't really talked about is Mississippi. Unusual circumstance there. 2 U.S. Senate seats up, but both you think are safely Republican?
Roger Wicker is up for re-election, and he's kind of been safe the entire cycle. The other one, Thad Cochran, was the incumbent, but he resigned due to poor health. The governor appointed Cindy Hyde Smith. I think she was the ag commissioner for the state. She's the first woman senator from Mississippi ever. She has been serving for several months now. She's obviously running for re-election. She's got the support of the party, of course, and big establishment money like the Chamber of Commerce. Chris McDaniel, who almost defeated Thad Cochran back in 2014, has attempted to challenge Cindy Hyde Smith for that seat, but his campaign has been plagued by incompetency and lack of fundraising and other things. So he's just not going to be competitive. So, yes, both of those Mississippi seats are safe, and they're safe in Republican hands.
Let's talk also a little bit more about Florida. There you have the governor, the Republican governor of Florida, Rick Scott, running against a Democrat incumbent. How has the recent hurricane there impacted that race? Because governors have to deal with the aftermath of hurricanes.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. When Rick Scott first got into the race, he immediately went on a media blitz and spent millions and millions of dollars. In fact, I think Florida is the most expensive Senate race right now, and that's due in large part because of his own spending, Rick Scott's spending. And he was able to create a fairly sizable lead in the polling, but Bill Nelson has fought back and has tightened the race to where it's now basically a coin flip. What's interesting here, though, is that because of the hurricanes, Rick Scott has had to somewhat suspend his campaign in order to provide the leadership that he needs to provide as governor of the state to get the state through that hurricane and the aftermath. But that role of being governor in the aftermath of that hurricane has provided him with a lot of earned media, and it has revealed itself that he is a good leader, and he has handled things well so far. So it's not like this has harmed his ability in the Senate race. But as I said before, the race is neck and neck. It's 50-50, and I don't think we're going to truly know who the winner is until Election Day.
Let's talk now for a minute or two about the House of Representatives. Everything that you've talked about, very rosy for Republicans in the Senate. Could be a little bit odd this year that one chamber might go one way and the other way. Are Democrats still favored to take control of the House of Representatives?
They are, and I think right now the question is how big is that margin of control going to be for the Democrats? I think if Republicans have their way, or if it's a very good night for Republicans, there's a small chance that Republicans could keep the majority, but what's more likely is that they will lose the majority, but Democrats will only have a single-digit majority of their own.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization, but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
They aren't going to make news headlines, but two key cases involving constitutional rights will be heard by the Supreme Court in November. We get details now from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, I'm just taking a solo look at these two important but maybe somewhat under the radar cases that will be in front of the Supreme Court, a session that really lacks a lot of high drama, not a lot of really major cases that could reshape major laws around the country. Basically nothing about guns or abortion or gay wedding cakes on the docket for this session. But there are these two important criminal justice cases, one of them Timms v. Indiana and the other Gamble v. United States. And let's start with that one. Gamble v. U.S. will be heard by the justices on December 5th at oral arguments. And what's at stake here is something called the separate sovereigns loophole in the Fifth Amendment. Now, that sounds very complicated or legalese, but it's actually pretty straightforward. Most people are probably pretty familiar with the idea of double jeopardy, the idea that you cannot be tried and convicted twice for the same crime. But there is this strange loophole that effectively allows you to be both tried and convicted at the state level and the federal level for the same crime. And Terrence Martez Gamble fell right into that loophole a few years ago. He was convicted in 2008 of second-degree robbery. And as a condition of that conviction, he was prohibited from owning a firearm under both state and federal law. Now, in 2015, Gamble was pulled over by the cops for having a busted taillight. They searched his car and they found a handgun in the car. So he ended up being convicted of unlawfully possessing a firearm, and he was convicted both by the state of Alabama and by the federal government. He won't be released from prison until February of 2020, that is 3 years later than if he had only been convicted at the state level. Now, Gamble has appealed his federal conviction on the grounds that he was being punished twice for the same crime, which, of course, the Fifth Amendment explicitly forbids. Unfortunately for Gamble, the Supreme Court has ruled that the same behavior actually can be punished under both federal and state law without violating the ban on double jeopardy because the state and the federal government are two distinct sovereigns. But this doctrine of separate sovereigns really has a bit of dubious legal history to it. It first arose in an 1852 case that had to do with fugitive slaves, and then it was upheld by the court in a Prohibition-era case, U.S. v. Lanza. And both of those rulings are kind of looked down on nowadays as having been poorly reasoned. So this case matters because there's been a push to federalize so many crimes in recent decades. And that means there's now really significant overlap between state and federal offenses, and that creates more opportunities for multiple convictions based on the same actions. That redundancy seems to conflict with the intent behind the Double Jeopardy Clause in the Fifth Amendment, and it also makes it harder for states and the federal government to set appropriate penalties, since neither really knows what the other will do or if the other will even seek out an additional conviction for the same crime. So a victory for Gamble in this case could mean tossing out a long-standing but poorly conceived Supreme Court precedent, or at least potentially limiting its use, and that would protect defendants from facing serial prosecutions for the same crime and ultimately increase liberty and be a significant reform to America's criminal justice system. So that's one case to keep your eye on. I think the other important criminal justice case in front of the court this session comes out of Indiana. The case is Timms v. Indiana. So what's at stake here is the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against excessive fines, and the question of whether that prohibition applies to the states as well as the federal government. The Supreme Court will hear the case, hear oral arguments in the case, on November 28th. The backstory here is that Tyson Timms was arrested in 2015 after selling heroin to undercover police officers. He's a criminal, and he doesn't dispute that. He pleaded guilty to one count of dealing a controlled substance and one count of conspiracy to commit theft, and he was sentenced to 1 year of house arrest followed by 5 years of probation. But he was also required to pay investigatory fees and court costs, and then on top of that, the state of Indiana seized his Land Rover, which he had purchased with money received from his late father's insurance payout, not from the proceeds of drug sales. But the state took the car on the grounds that it had been used in the process of committing a crime, basically that he had carried drugs in the car, and so they had a right to forfeit it. Now, Timms has appealed the forfeiture of his vehicle. He's not appealing his conviction. He's not appealing other parts of his sentence. He's only appealing the forfeiture of his vehicle, arguing that he was already being punished for the crime and that seizing the truck valued at $40,000 violated the Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive fines. An appeals court found that the forfeiture of the Land Rover was grossly disproportional because it amounted to a penalty that was about four times the maximum monetary fine for the crimes that Timms had actually committed and was already being punished for. The Indiana Supreme Court, however, overturned that decision on the ground that the ban on excessive fines only applies at the federal level and not to the states. So the legal background here is really interesting and important. The Supreme Court has a long track record of ruling on multiple occasions that the various limitations on government power included in the Bill of Rights apply to the states as well as the federal government. And that happens because of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. So in 1962, for example, the Supreme Court ruled that the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment applies to the states. And in 2015, it reached the exact same conclusion about the Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive bail. But the court has never explicitly said that the amendment's prohibition on excessive fines and fees also applies to the state. And so the Supreme Court seems to have taken this case because it gives them an opportunity to do exactly that, to clear up that, yes, indeed, the Constitution's ban on excessive fines does apply to the states. And this would have important ramifications for civil asset forfeiture proceedings. A decision applying the excessive fines clause to the state level would make it far easier to challenge unreasonable fines and fees, including not just forfeiture, but also cases where local governments have hit homeowners with massive civil penalties for offenses like unapproved paint jobs or having Halloween decorations up for too long. The fact that some local governments use those fines and fees as a means to raise revenue has created a perverse incentive to target residents unfairly or to go after people who are just minding their own business. So a victory for Timms in this case would be an important step towards curbing that sort of local and state government abuse, and it would also be a significant blow to the problems created by civil asset forfeiture. So these are two big cases, Gamble and Timms. They're not cases that are necessarily going to capture the news media's attention. They're not going to be all over the front page of the New York Times. The oral arguments here that take place November 28th and December 5th are worth paying attention to, and the rulings when they come out early next year could have important ramifications for the criminal justice system, and I think more importantly for the rights of Americans, the rights that are already enshrined in the Constitution but are not necessarily always present in the actual practice of the criminal justice system. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Sprint-T-Mobile merger is now before the Federal Communications Commission, triggering a debate over competitiveness. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary.
As a conservative, I'm a fervent believer in the free market and the economic value of competition, and thus I usually oppose mergers because they tend to reduce competition. Competition keeps prices low and thus benefits consumers. There's a proposed merger that is now seeking government approval that is different, however. It's the proposed merger between wireless carriers Sprint and T-Mobile. As a longtime Sprint Mobile customer, I have more than just a passing or theoretical interest in this one, and I've concluded that it's one of those rare mergers that is likely to preserve rather than reduce competition. Here's why. The mobile or wireless industry is complex, but there are essentially two types of players. One is what they call mobile network operators, or MNOs. Those are the companies that own and operate cell phone towers and their networks. There are four of them: Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile. The other players, like Consumer Cellular, Cricket, Metro PCS, and U.S. Cellular, are what's called mobile virtual network operators, or MVNOs. There are dozens of them, and they do not own or operate their own cellular networks. They basically piggyback on the four MNOs, buying access at wholesale rates. The MVNOs are fierce competitors, and their innovative rate plans and discounts hold down rates for everyone. Of the big four MNOs, Verizon and AT&T are roughly the same size, and each is roughly twice the size of Sprint and T-Mobile. The mobile industry is on the cusp of the next big technology in mobile communications called 5G. The 5G mobile technology will carry more than 20 times the data load of the current 4G technology. This means faster download times for bandwidth-hungry applications like HD video, and it's even more than 20 times faster for certain other types of data. 5G technology will be very expensive to implement, however. It will cost literally billions upon billions of dollars, and that's where this merger makes sense. Verizon and AT&T both have capital and access to capital in the order of magnitude required to roll out 5G. Sprint and T-Mobile are capital constrained by comparison. Because of this, it will take them longer to update their networks, and in the meantime, they will be operating at a competitive disadvantage in a marketplace that values the latest technology and where customer loyalty is at best a secondary consideration. The resultant likelihood is that Verizon and AT&T would pick off millions of technology-obsessed customers from Sprint and T-Mobile, further enlarging the two big players and shrinking the two smaller MNOs. It wouldn't be long before they're easy picking for mergers with the big two, leading to only two long-term MNO survivors. But if the two smaller MNOs' proposed merger is approved, there would be three surviving MNOs of comparable size. So the question before the FCC and the Department of Justice is not whether it is in the public interest to go from four MNOs to three, but whether it is better in the long run to have three MNOs than two. Three MNOs will also compete more vigorously for the business of dozens of MVNOs. If there are only two MNOs, then there's a good chance that they'll ease into a kind of oligopoly of two players who don't really compete head-to-head, but rather decide to carve up the MVNO marketplace between them, probably geographically. That would further reduce competition in the mobile communications space. I would urge faithful listeners of American Radio Journal to contact their senators and members of Congress and tell them to support the Sprint and T-Mobile proposed merger. It's one of those rare cases where a merger would promote rather than reduce competition and thus is in the public interest. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WJPH-FM in Woodbine, New Jersey, KSOO-AM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, along with WBFD-AM in Bedford, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.